This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 278, where today we're going to talk to Rob Windsor, Microsoft MVP, about using Microsoft Flow for SharePoint developers. Recorded live November the 1st, 2018.
Struggling to reproduce problems in your code base? Successful software starts with Raygun. Raygun provides application performance monitoring, unlike anything that you've experienced before, offering greater clarity around how your software is performing for your customers than any other APM provider. Easily detect and diagnose issues impacting end users and monitor every part of your stack in one place. It's time to get back to building great software instead of fighting it. Start your journey to better software quality and try Raygun for free at raygun.com today.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Microsoft Cloud Show. Today I'm flying solo. This is AC. I'm flying solo without my trusty co-host, Chris Johnson, who's had a conflict to pop up during our normal recording time. But as you'll see, we've got a great guest on. We didn't want to postpone anything further from when we had already kind of scheduled this far enough out. So I want to make sure we still got a chance to record this today. Before we dive into this, though, and dive into our discussion, I do have a little bit of news and a little bit of updates to share. So first on the update, I had mentioned last week with CJ that I was in the middle of doing some big updates with Boitanos. And today actually is, by the time you hear this, comes out early, got to be November the 6th. I'm recording this on Thursday, November the 1st. And today, launching a bunch of new content and updated content for my course on mastering the SharePoint framework. I have a new chapter that's specifically on Angular and using Angular 7 and taking advantage of a feature that Angular added a previous version, an Angular 6, called Angular Elements. So for developers who want to use Angular inside of SharePoint framework projects, I have a whole new chapter on that, about an hour and a half long worth of content there with three really beefy demos in it. And then I've added a couple lessons to existing chapters. One is on deploying extensions to tenant-wide. So the new capability was added in 1.6 of the SharePoint framework. And that is now in there as well. There's an explanation lesson and then a demo showing how to go about doing that. And then I have another pair of lessons that I added to the React chapter. Back in Sprint 11 is when I had published my automated testing chapter and showing you how to use Jest for automated testing. I've added in two additional lessons to the existing React chapter to show how to take your React project and use that automated testing features, but to also test the rendering of your React application. So it shows you how to do the testing with the rendering, shows you how to use this a library from Airbnb that's really popular for the rendering called Enzyme, more powerful than the one that we get out of the box and from React and Jest. And furthermore, it even shows you how to simulate events and test to make sure that events are passing the right methods and stuff. So we simulate a button click and test all that stuff. So a lot of new content there, plus a bunch of just little punch list items that people have found and updates that didn't warrant new videos or anything, but just some small tweaks. So those are the big things, or the big update. That's all available for customers today. And then I've also got a pair of webinars that I'm doing in the middle of November. So about a week from when this episode comes out, if you head over to the site and go to the store, you'll see go to voitanos.io and click on the store, you'll see I have two webinars. You can think of them as like lunch and learns. They're about 2 hours long on November the 13th and the 14th. And the idea is that I get that some people don't have the time or the money to invest in a full-blown, you know, course with 30 some odd hours in it, or want to spend, you know, over $400 on a course. So these are much cheaper, much more affordable options, and that you can, you know, kind of try if you want to see if this is the content that you like. It's content straight from the course. It's just presented live, and as a little, you know, hint just for you guys that are listening, if you wanted to upgrade, if you liked it and you ended up wanting to upgrade and using it as kind of try before you really buy the class, just ping us or open a support ticket after you do the webinar, and you'll see it. We'll offer to kind of commute your investment already in the webinar. We'll basically give you the webinar for free, and we'll just apply that the cost of the webinar to the price of the course.
A 99.9% SLA means you're protected from power outages, bad patches, natural disasters, and maybe even a dinosaur attack. Does it protect you from yourself though? AvePoint Backup for SharePoint Online provides full fidelity backup and recovery, from individual items to entire team sites. AvePoint can run backups up to 4 times a day to ensure your data is secure. Recover anytime you want without having to pick up the phone and schedule restore windows. Learn why AvePoint is the Microsoft Cloud expert at www.avpoint.com.
Okay, so there's two bits of news that I do want to share with you that happened in the industry or kind of comment on really quick. One of them is pretty big, and one of them actually is very big, and that's IBM is acquiring Red Hat. This is a huge, huge investment that IBM has. It's a pretty big investment that they had. Red Hat is going to still remain to be a distinct unit all by itself, but it is still or independent, kind of like how GitHub is with Microsoft. But IBM is now the parent company of Red Hat. Red Hat, big in the Linux space, big in the container space. It's a really big move for IBM to take advantage of getting into this market here. So I'm going to have a link to this news in the show notes if you're interested in reading a little bit more over to the Red Hat blog that explains it. Another bit of news here that I wanted to, or I guess an update from our previous episode, CJ and I talked a little bit about how GitHub, well, we mentioned how GitHub, the acquisition was final in the end of the last quarter with the quarterly update that we reviewed back in episode 277 of Microsoft's quarterly report. And CJ mentioned that over the course of the previous weekend from when we recorded, there was an issue when GitHub went down and was down for a little over 24 hours. I think it was they had a degradation of service for 24 hours and 11 minutes. Most of the platform was not affected, but significant pieces were. And this all happened on, I believe it was a Sunday, October the 21st. I believe that was a Sunday. And what they've done, though, is on October the 30th, GitHub published a post-incident analysis of their October the 21st issue. And it's a, man, I tell you, this is the kind of thing that when Azure had the September the 4th meltdown in the South Central Data Center, there were a couple different places where you had to go to get a post-incident analysis of what happened. This is the kind of the gold standard. This is what I would be looking for from GitHub. They walked through all the details of what happened. They had some issue between their east and west data centers. Things started to automatically fail over. And within about 2 minutes, the failover did not go as planned. Things got out of sync. And they had an issue. I'm going to summarize this, but they had an issue where some writes were happening for a few minutes on the east data center, and then about 30 minutes where writes were happening on the west data center, but they were all happening at the same time. And they couldn't just merge the two together because they could have been conflicts. What that did is that caused a real data consistency problem between the two clusters. And it showed, they realized that the only thing we can do is fail forward. We have to accept the 30 minutes of changes, and we have to somehow remediate the changes that happened on the east side for about 2 or 3 minutes. So they walked through all the details of what happened and how they addressed it and why it took so long. And the main reason why it took so long is because they had huge database clusters, some of them hundreds of gigabytes, some of them terabytes. And those are all stored in cloud storage. And so it took a long time to restore those down or to download all those big backups and then multiple hours to restore those. And while that was going on, they had to shut down webhooks and a couple other things as well. So there was some, I guess you could say there was some data loss, but they explain how they made the decisions that they did not want the data to be inconsistent, and they wanted to make sure that there was a very slim chance for data loss. And where there was an issue, they could at least provide, here's what happened, here's the changes you tried to make. And if you need to go back and update or apply those changes, you have to do it manually. So it's a really good chronology of what happened, what they're doing to change this. It just really shows, though, that, I mean, this is not a problem I think that most of us would deal with, but it's one that is it's a pretty huge issue, a huge cloud architecture issue that you've got to end up dealing with. That is just, it's just hard to, this is cloud at scale can just be tough. And this just shows that it's a pretty big challenge. So those are the two bits of news that I wanted to cover. One, IBM acquires Red Hat, and a post-incident analysis from GitHub. So with that, let's transition to the next part of the show, the meat and potatoes of the show. And we'll have a cool discussion here on the whole reason we're doing this episode.
Inbox Zero is a thing of the past. We're also inundated with email, and that's where Samebox comes in. Think of it as an EMT for your email. As messages flow in, Samebox does the triage for you. Sane later sifts through all the distracting stuff out of your inbox so that you can focus only on the important emails. And that's just a taste. It also has nifty features like the Sane Black Hole and Sane Reminders. And best of all, you can use Samebox with any email client or phone anywhere you check your email. See how Samebox can magically remove distractions from your inbox with a free 2-week trial. Visit samebox.com/MSCloudShow today to start your free trial and get a $25 credit.
Okay, today I have with me Rob Windsor. Rob Windsor is a lead consultant with the Pate Group and the chief Imagineer with Extacloud. Rob has been writing code in some form or another for more than 25 years and currently spends most of his time writing C#, JavaScript, and TypeScript to build customizations for SharePoint Online. For the last 15 years, Rob has been recognized as a Microsoft Most Valuable Professional for his commitment to helping the developer community. So Rob, hey, welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show.
Hey, AC, how's it going?
Doing good, man.
Great to be here.
Man, you know, this is one of the, every once in a while we get a guest on and you kind of realize it's like, we talk about stuff on the show all the time. We talk at all these conferences and you realize that we haven't gotten this guy on the show yet. This is core. It's been so long. It's like, it's way overdue. So, hey, it's nice to finally get you on the show, man. This is I'm glad you reached out about this topic because this is one that I don't have a ton of experience with, but I know there's a lot of people out there that are interested in it.
Yeah. I mean, you go to conferences and the Power Apps and Flow sessions are packed. There's tons and tons of interest in these tools. So it's interesting. I'm relatively new to Flow, to be honest with you. It's been 6 months-ish since I've really started to pick it up. And even in that time, it's amazing how much it's evolved and how much more adoption I'm seeing of the tool.
Yeah, you and I, you know, it's funny. So what we're going to talk about today is, you know, Rob has been spending a lot of time with Flow lately, and specifically is coming at it from the angle of, tell me if this is fair to say, coming at it from the angle of like replacing or using it as the replacement for what we used to do workflows inside of SharePoint to be able to automate stuff or to instrument things that we were doing inside of SharePoint. Is that
fair? Yeah, so the two sort of core scenarios with Flow are approvals and notifications, right? So in that area, I think there's a lot of overlap with what people would have done with SharePoint Designer workflows in the past. But there's a lot of things you can do with Flow that you couldn't have done with SharePoint Designer workflows. So there's definitely like a similarity between the two things, but from a feature comparison, the Flow is like way more robust.
Gotcha. Yeah. That's what we end up pushing a lot of people to. They ask about, you know, where's the, like in my class, I get a lot of people asking about, you know, where's the workflow piece to your class? It's like, well, I mean, in one sense, it's nice. Well, I guess to me, it's and overall, it's nice where you see the SharePoint team, they're carving out pieces of SharePoint. It's almost like they're getting better by removing non-core things. And like workflow was one of those. I mean, we had workflow or three different variations or flavors of it. Iterations is probably a better word of it in the SharePoint platform starting back in 2007. And now workflow is really, I mean, there is still some legacy stuff that's there, but you know, if you're starting Greenfield, you're not going to build a quote SharePoint workflow. Everything's going to be pushed over to Flow, which is nice because Flow is not just a SharePoint tool. It can be used as SharePoint, but it's not just a SharePoint tool. It's more of a core kind of a value add service or an enabling technology that we can take advantage of. So one of the things that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, we started trading some discussion about this. I'm trying to remember when we did this. It might have been, it was on some online thing that we were both engaged on.
It was your office hours, actually, for Voitanos. That's where the question came up from one of the attendees. And you started at it from, okay, let's go into Azure AD and build and register an app. And then coming at it from that point, and I'm like, well, you could do this with Flow. And then we kind of went back and forth on, okay, well, you know, how would you attack it from the sort of more developer-y point of view, right, with Azure AD app and all this kind of stuff, using 8LJS and these kinds of things, or the new types within the SharePoint framework. And I'm like, well, from Flow, there's an action in there, a connector and an action that you can use and get it done in a few minutes. So that's kind of where the genesis of this whole thing came up, yeah.
Yeah, and it's an interesting approach, right? Because I find myself having to I consciously try to check myself every time somebody says, well, how do you do this? And my head immediately goes, part because I enjoy it, and part just because that's where I seem to most of my life, where I spend my time, I go straight to the code. I'm just like, well, what can I do with the REST API and how can I authenticate to this and what code can I write to do this thing? But I consciously, over the last few years, I try to first say, what is there that is already available to me that I can leverage that is less code to write? And to me, I guess more importantly now these days is less code to maintain, less custom stuff to maintain. And if it's something that I can...
Every line of code you don't write is a line of code you don't have to maintain, right?
Exactly, yeah. It's one less thing that's going to break. And especially, well, I guess I was more conscious to it when, you know, being more of a small business now, where the last thing I want to do is to see something that I write to kind of help instrument my business. If I see that break, I don't want to have to stop doing what I'm doing because now the business has come, you know, screeching to a halt because based on something that I did. It's like, no, you know what? I'd rather pay for the service for somebody else, let somebody else manage it. And that's kind of, you know, kind of an approach with flow as well. I mean, with workflow, it's like, well, I can go build a workflow. Sure, you can go build a workflow and sure, you can go write the code for this. But like you said, you know, I think more in like the kind of code model, but it's flow is something I know you need to spend more, I know I need to spend more time on and get a little bit more familiar with it to see the stuff that it can end up doing.
Yeah. So 6 months ago, I would have been in exactly the same spot that you are, right? Like I was aware of flow, but I didn't realize what it's, well, actually 6 months ago, the capabilities that I use most frequently in flow were not there. So that was one thing, right? But again, I just wasn't aware of what flow could do for me. So I would have taken the exact same approach, right? And now that I know what flow has available for me, then, you know, in certain scenarios that I can do with flow in 5 minutes, what it would take me, you know, a couple hours to do with going and getting an app and registering and building the code to go consume that app and all that kind of stuff. So
let's look at something like that. I mean, you say that, you know, that there's stuff that you would have done as code. Now you're like, no, 5 minutes, I can knock it out in flow. And whether you could have done it back 6 months ago and now it was just a experience kind of a thing, or it was, hey, there was not the feature or functionality that was available to me at the time. Can you give us an example of what one of those things is and like kind of explain how you approach it?
Here's a really easy example. What Office 365 groups do I belong to, right? So, I mean, there's different triggers I could use, but in that case, I probably use an HTTP request trigger, right? Mm-hmm. So I can trigger that flow with an HTTP request. It's one action to find out what groups I belong to. Well, actually, sorry, one action to get the IDs of the groups that I belong to, and then you use another one to get the more detailed information, and then you mm-hmm. return that as JSON. So it's literally 5-10 minutes to build the flow. And then because it's an HTTP request trigger, I can then call that from another flow. I can call that from SharePoint framework. I can call that from JavaScript code running in a content editor web part. I can call it from pretty much anywhere I can make a HTTP request and get back JSON.
How much of the things that you're building are like you see are like utilities for you, or is it like a utility for like something that a customer needs inside of a project? So like, for example, I have a newsletter that I push out once every 2 weeks. And I, throughout 2 weeks, a couple times on a scheduled basis, but then also just on demand, when I see something that is SharePoint developer focused, I tag it, I put it inside of a SharePoint list. And then I go back once every 2 weeks, I update the SharePoint list, put my comments in it, categorize, you know, what is it? Is it news? Is it a resource? Is it a community like blog post? And is it now ready to go through in the newsletter? And then once everything's done and my view is now empty of all the stuff that's to process, I create a flow button and go on my phone, click the button, and then I wait to see a file show up inside of a Google Drive folder or OneDrive folder. What that did is that just took a bunch of HTML and like that I had templated out, and it basically just builds the entire newsletter, all the HTML source to it, copy paste that right into the newsletter email program I have and just let it go.
Yeah, so I have some flows that I use. Well, one personally, right? For example, I just get distracted and I just don't think of things. So every morning at 10 a.m., I get an email from Flow telling me to take my BP meds, right? There's one. Another one is actually from the show. Can't remember how, maybe 6 weeks ago, you had a show where one of the things you talked about was there's no way to get an email that tells you when your app secrets are expiring. I went into Flow, I went into the Graph Explorer, checked to see, is there an endpoint I can hit to go find out information about my registered apps? There is. It's in the beta. It's a beta endpoint, but you can still hit it. So yeah. I built a flow to go check my app secrets and tell me when they're going to expire. So, I mean, there's lots of different things you can do. I would say for me personally, it's about a 90-10 split in terms of flows I'm building, you know, for clients to enhance business processes, and then 10 personal or whatever to help me internally kind of thing.
Okay. So let me ask you another thing too. So, this is going to go off into a few questions with this. So how would you position flow to a customer today? I mean, I can see it, you know, as a developer, we'll come to that in just a minute, but how would you position this to someone? Would you go to someone and say that the target audience or the persona that usually would crack open SharePoint Designer and would go to create a new workflow? Do you think flow is a good replacement for that? Or is it something that is a bit more technical and you say, no, I don't think it's going to be like an end user, you know, go create a process to do an approval or something. Instead, it really is going to require a little bit more technical kind of a background.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way that Microsoft positions flow is they sometimes say no code, which drives me insane, but low code is what you more often hear, right? Tool. So when what's low code? Well, if you understand how to build formulas in Excel, then you should be able to use flow. Okay. And for a subset of scenarios, that's true, right? So you can definitely go in and do things like notifications and approvals without being super technical. You might have to be a tiny bit technical, but definitely most power users would be able to do that. But once you get to any level of complexity, it no longer becomes low code. Yeah. Here's a perfect example, right? I have a value that can be null, an empty string, or a string with stuff in it, right? So how do I know, does the string have stuff in it or not? Well, I've got to coalesce the null value into a string and then check the length of the string is greater than zero. Where, well, as soon as you say coalesce a null value to a power user, that's no longer low code, in my opinion, right? So that's just one example. Commonly, you're going to have to understand HTTP status codes. Again, that's not something that is, to me, low code, right? So there's definitely value there for the power user, but I think the real value is for somebody who has some developer chops.
Okay, that brings up another point then. So one of the challenges that I had, so I've tried to use Flow and I've run into hearing that a lot of stuff has changed in the last 6 months. I probably need to go back in and try some other stuff. So I have a lot of experience with Zapier, which is similar to Flow in some respects. It's got the whole connector model. It's got the ability to create a workflow and different runs and stuff, a lot of integrations. And at the time, I found it to be a little bit easier to work with because it was easier to post messages to Slack, which is a tool that I spend a lot of my time in from Zapier than it was from Flow. Some of the Flow ones didn't work as well as I thought, but they didn't work as well with Slack as I thought that they could have. But then there was other things that I found really hard to do or not even possible inside of Flow that Zapier had native integration to. So I found that I was like I kept running all these different dead ends. I'm trying to do this. And I found it to be a hard time going in and finding support, a place to ask questions that were more than just someone who's being paid to answer questions and give me links to a knowledge base article that I've already found. Mm-hmm. But like some of the things I was trying to do is I have a flow that checks, I think it's every 30 minutes or every hour. I run some sort of request using NPM to tell it that I want JSON back for a list of all the version numbers of the SharePoint framework generator. And it gets the most current looks at the JSON string that comes back, looks for a very specific value and extracts that value. And then it says, all right, now that I know what that number is, let's go to a SharePoint list and let's look up in the SharePoint list to find an item with that same number in it. And if it does not exist, then I know that in the last 30 minutes, there's a new SharePoint framework generator that's been released. Mm-hmm. So I took that. I then add a new entry to the SharePoint list. I then go have another flow that watches that SharePoint list to see if there's any updates to it or any new things added to it. And if there are, it sends a push notification to me to say new version of the SharePoint framework just got updated. And then it also sends out a tweet from the Voitanos Twitter account that says, hey, Microsoft just released a new version of the SharePoint framework. People think that I'm over there refreshing it all the time. Really, all it is just putting a message out. There's other stuff that I'd like to do with it. But in building that, like you said, there was a lot more work that was involved in it. There was a lot of processing JSON. There was a lot of understanding how to do an HTTP request and how to not just process JSON, but how to take those values, the results from one, I think in Flow they call them activities. Is that right?
Actions,
yeah. So the results from one action and use the results from that action inside of another action. I found working with JSON to be a little tricky. I found the expression editor to be a little, it was different than anything else I had worked with before in some of the expressions. And then one of the other challenges that I had, there's a reason for me going on this diatribe. One of the other challenges I had is that as a developer, doing all this configuration stuff inside of the browser, and then when I made one error, one or two times I had to end up throwing the whole thing away and coming back in, either because I didn't know better or I couldn't figure out how to save and version what I was working on to be able to test it iteratively as a developer. And then having that confidence to where right now, if it said, my documentation is, I go into the flow and I have screenshots, a boatload of screenshots that are all sitting in a OneNote file. And if all of a sudden that flow accidentally gets deleted, I've got to manually go back and recreate that where the code side of me just says, oh no, it's in a repo. Just go through and rebuild it and repush it. How do you like approach that challenge as somebody who's like, I'm using flow in a developer-y kind of way, but I want to have more of like that reusability, one, and being able to save those things. And then also, the challenges I was running into that I just explained, do you find that that stuff has gotten easier in the last, since you started really diving into it?
Are you being asked repeatedly to integrate different business systems and ever narrower timeframes with increasing process complexity? What if you could standardize the way you build these business processes so your team are focused on higher value tasks versus the nuts and bolts of running the processes and integrations? Nintex can make that happen. With the Nintex platform, work flows from person to person, system to system, to the cloud and back. Got a custom system you want to connect with? No-code extensions let you plug into systems simply and easily using REST and Swagger. With Nintex, work just flows, so your teams can work smarter, work faster, and be more connected than ever. Try it out for free for 30 days at www.nintex.com/trynwc.
There's about seven questions in there.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. So first off, that scenario you just described is a perfect example of some of the value of flow. You're taking all these different systems and integrating them together in a way. So you're talking about NPM, you're talking about SharePoint, you're talking about Twitter, all these things, right? So that's really what it's about. There's all these connectors, right? There's, I don't know, tens of connectors, maybe more than 100 connectors you can use. Some of them are free and some of them are premium that provide you the ability to build these things that integrate all these systems together. So that's one thing. Second thing is you talked about sort of the being able to restore the flow, let's say, for example. So you have a couple different options there. One option is that you can export any flow generally to a zip file. And there's another format, I can't remember, it might be JSON. So you can export a flow, save it off, and then if for some reason something happens, you can always restore from that. So you can one of the options is to create a new flow or to import a flow, and you just point it at the zip file and it will bring that in. And then all you need to do is just rehook up the connectors, right? Another option, there's a blog post by John Liu. He's Australian, I believe.
Yeah.
And he has a flow that will go in and use the flow management connector to find all your flows, get the JSON from them, and throw them into SharePoint. So that's another option, right? So there's a few different options. In terms of like integration with flow and like Git or something like that, that's a little bit, I mean, I guess you could get the JSON and then check that into Git using a flow. Mm-hmm. Would be another option too.
That'd be a nice a connector. Or can you build a flow that is kind of like packaged? So I could build a flow and share it with other people and say, like, Rob, you can take this flow and you can integrate it into my, and like a reusable component kind of a thing.
Yeah. So I haven't really looked at it in too much detail, but I believe there's a public flow gallery that you can submit flows to. But in terms of what you're talking about, it's more like export the flow from my tenant and give it to you, and you can import that into your tenant.
Yeah.
I really haven't explored how the public gallery works and how you submit to that. And can you do multi-tenant flows? I can't tell you, unfortunately.
Okay. I have another question for you then. So I know that there's a way with Flow that we have the ability to, I know Flow is like just is a UI on top of Logic Apps.
So that's exactly right. Yeah.
All right. So, and I hear people say, well, if you're a developer, you can always jump over to building a Logic App. And so one side of me is like, well, where's that line? I get, have you experienced in some of your work, have you experienced where that line is so that, you know, I could look at that and say, let me give you an analogy. Back when it was just SharePoint framework based, or sorry, SharePoint designer based workflows, and we had workflow manager inside SharePoint server and in SharePoint online, we could build workflows with SharePoint designer, and it had the ability to call REST API and do some stuff. And then we had the ability as a developer to build a workflow with workflow manager and do some really complex stuff in it and troubleshooting, debugging, and all that stuff. I remember building a workflow course many years ago and showing how to call a REST API and do some work with this REST API, both from Workflow Manager and from SharePoint Designer. And I know that now, and I did the SharePoint Designer one, honestly, just to check the box. But when I would sit down and talk to a customer and they'd be like, well, I want to talk to this REST API and I'm trying to do it within SharePoint Designer. I immediately just start, your gut reaction's kind of like, this isn't really the tool to do that. This is, you're kind of going a little bit too deep here. And it's like, you bought a Porsche, like a 911. And is it a car? Absolutely. Does it a car that go on the road? Yes, it's designed for that. Like, well, yeah, but I want to be able to take it to the beach and drag my boat to the beach on it. It's like, okay, so I guess technically, yeah, you can do that, right?
Well, you can get to the beach. Whether you ever get to the water would be a second another story, right?
Sure, yeah. But I mean, that's, you know, and I'm not making fun of anybody specifically, but because I can't think of a person to actually make fun of with this. But I'm sure someone, you know, we've all dealt with customers who would say, but yeah, but what if I got a bunch of plywood and I put it in the boat and then I took it out and I drove the car back on the thing, kind of put it in there? And you're like, okay, yeah, okay, you could do that. But there's another tool for this job that's going to work a lot better. better. And it's kind of more designed for that. When I sit down and start working with Flow, sometimes I feel like I kind of, and this is part of my inexperience, start to wonder like, you know, am I going too far with this? Is this something that I really should say, you know what, maybe I should really focus on doing a logic app instead of building a Flow? Have you run across this in any of your work?
Yes, but not in the way that you just, in a different way than you just described it, right? So generally, from what I've seen, it isn't, should I do a Flow or should I do a logic app? It's once I get beyond a certain level of complexity or there's things I just cannot do in Flow, then it's, what about an Azure function or a custom service, right?
Right.
So, yep. And you can call either of those from a Flow, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously there's things, well, I shouldn't say obviously. There are things you can do in logic apps that you can't do in Flow. But generally it isn't like, oh, I'm going to move my Flow to a logic app to bridge that complexity. It's, am I going to bring in Azure functions or a custom service or something else? That's really okay. What generally you're talking about. And from a customer standpoint, one of the things, especially, you know, I do a lot of work with small and medium-sized businesses, right? And if you have a tenant, an Office 365 or Dynamics tenant, you get 2,000 Flow executions per user per month, right? And that's included in the cost. Well, there's no extra cost above that, right? Mm-hmm. But as soon as you start talking about logic apps or Azure functions or whatever, even though it's a very, very minimal cost, as soon as you say to the client, there's going to be an additional cost, sometimes that's a game breaker for them. So even if you say, it's only going to be $1 or $2 a month, they just say, no, I just don't want to do that, right? But assuming that's not an issue, then absolutely you can start to bring in additional functionality with generally Azure Functions is this next step up is where people are going
to
go.
So going to the, that's a good point to say. I didn't think about it like that. When it comes down to the pricing and the licensing thing, and I know we're both developers at heart, so I don't want to get too deep into licensing. This is a minefield to kind of wade into. One thing I was always confused about was it seems like, you know, a lot of the workflows that I'm going to create, although in SharePoint, a lot of stuff is user-based, but some stuff may be like based on a timer. So for example, Rob, I hire you and I want you to build a flow for me that's going to run on a scheduled basis, maybe once every hour. Mm-hmm. It's not really tied to a person. It's just a flow that's been set up to run that's going to do some work once an hour, send out a notification, like the one that you mentioned for the SharePoint framework, new update to the SharePoint framework, or the blood pressure one that you mentioned.
Right.
How is that allocated to the person? Is that allocated to the person that wrote the flow? Or is it like, if I hired you to come into the organization and to write this flow for me, and then you're here as a contractor and then you leave, do you build it and then I have to be the one to kind of take ownership of it and the quota goes against me?
Right. So there's a couple things there. So the first one is in terms of ownership, right? So when you author a flow, it's your flow. You are the author of that flow. You're the only one who can go in and modify it, right? But you can assign other people to be owners of the flow, which means that then they can also go in and author and they can see analytics on the flow and all that kind of stuff, right? So that's from an ownership standpoint in terms of authoring, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. In terms of how do I authenticate? So when I want to talk to SharePoint or Outlook or whatever it happens to be, how do I authenticate? So for the vast majority of flows, it's done through a service account. So when I say I want to use SharePoint, it's going to say, okay, what's the connection you're going to use to authenticate to SharePoint? And generally, that's going to be a service account, right? So by default, it's whoever the author is, right? So if I go into it to author a flow, it's going to say, well, I'm connecting to SharePoint as me in whatever, you know, whatever account I have in that particular tenant. But then you can change it to say, no, I want to connect to this service as this service account. And most organizations will set up a Flow service account, okay?
Okay.
So the only scenario where you can connect to Flow as the actual user is in what's called a button flow, right? You talked about a button flow that you can launch from the app, right? So for example, if you go into a SharePoint modern document library, in the command bar, there's an option for Flow. And you can go in and say, create a flow. And then what the user will do is they'll pick one or more documents. Generally, it's one document from that library. And then they can go into the flow options and start that flow. And then over where the details pane pops out, there'll be a button to say start the flow. Okay, so that is also a button flow. So in the case of a button flow, you can say connect to whatever backend services you're using as the current user. But that's the only scenario where you can do that. Otherwise, you're always connecting as some predefined account that the author of the flow designates.
Is that, and you're saying that if I have more than you said 2,000 executions, is that right?
2,000, well, so if you have a tenant, right, an Office 365 or Dynamics tenant, it's 2,000 per user per month, and those are pooled. So it's not specific to the user. The only time it's specific to the user is if you're using free flow, right? So that you have an email account, and you can use 750 executions, and that's specific to that account.
So, so if I have 9 people in my tenant, right, and then I go to create an additional user in my tenant, so get a license for this person. Now I have 10 people that are in it. I have 10 times 2,000 executions
per month. Yeah.
And if those 9 real people, those 9 individuals, if they didn't run a single one, then that 2,000 times 10 executions could be used all entirely by that service account, that tenth user that was created.
Yeah. So again, it's 10 times 2,000 or 9 times 2,000. That's how many you get, right? And it doesn't matter if the flow takes 1 minute to execute or 30 days to execute. And if it has 1 action in it or 50 actions in it, it's just 1 execution, okay? So now where you start to have to think about it is when you start to modularize your flows. And the way you do that is by using the HTTP request action or trigger that I mentioned earlier, right? So it might make sense to break down your flow into several subcomponents, right? So the one flow is triggered by, let's say, for example, I add an item to a SharePoint list. And then that does some work, and then it triggers another flow through an HTTP request, and that does some work, and then that triggers another flow, or later on you trigger, you know, so whatever, you're calling the subcomponents through these HTTP requests, right?
Right.
So if your flow calls 3 other flows through this mechanism, then that's 4 executions, not just 1, right?
Okay.
And the only place you're really going to get in trouble with that is, like, for example, I have a trigger on an email received, right? Mm. Well, you can blow through a lot of executions really, really quick in that scenario, right? But for most standard scenarios, like add an item to a list or even modify an item, it's going to be hard to go through all of your executions in a given month with any significant number of users in your tenant, right?
Okay. I guess the licensing, the part that always confused me then was that when they would say it was tied, that it was the number of executions is a quota that's assigned or a per person. I didn't realize they were pulled together. So I was always confused by, you know, who's going to make this and who's going to run. If you got one really heavy user in there, is that, do they have to have a bigger quota that you can end up adding to them? That's not the case, because it really is, you get a number of tenant executions, and that number is calculated based on the number of licenses that you have in your organization.
Right. Now, okay. In terms of licensing, I'll just mention briefly that there are plans above the 2,000. So there's Flow Plan 1 and Flow Plan 2. Flow Plan 1 is $5 per user per month, and it provides additional flow executions and additional management capabilities and so on. And then Plan 2 is $15 per user per month. And again, it provides additional capabilities beyond that. So, and it's 4,500 and 15,000 executions per user per month.
Okay. So for another 15 bucks for a user, you can ramp up that from that 2,000. You could jump that all the way up to 15,000.
Yeah. And if you don't want to go into the plans, you can just buy extra executions. So 50,000 executions is $40 a month.
That's not so bad.
So yeah, again, you got to be doing a lot of flows or doing flows that trigger on things that happen very, very often to really go through your executions per month, I've found. Again, well, now I'm working with mostly small and medium-sized businesses, so you have to take that into account.
Yeah, and that's got a pretty, how should I say it? That's got a really good price structure though when you compare it to something like Zapier, like the competition, where, you know, Zapier, you have a number of zaps, which is like a flow, and you have the actions inside of the zap. They call those tasks, and those are counted separately. So you have 2 separate things that you end up counting. And I think, like, if you have more than, I think if you have, you get like 5 for free, 5 zaps for free. And then to get up to like 20 or 25 zaps, you have to get a premium account, which gives you, I think, 25 zaps. It gives you some other actions that are available for premium customers. But it's still, I mean, that's not the number of executions. It's tied more to the number of apps that you have or zaps that you have, instead of it being tied to the number of executions you have. You can have just one that is incredibly active and you're still inside the free plan. But the flow sounds like it works a lot differently. Huh, that's cool.
Yeah, so I believe Logic Apps, it's per action, the price. I mean, it's micro cents, I think it is per action, but it is charged per action within the Logic App, whereas flow is per execution.
Let me ask you a couple other questions too about people who potentially are considering this. What do you see on the stability side? Like, do you see that flow is fairly reliable? I know that early on, and I don't know if this has changed. Early on, I remember where you could set it that I wanted it to run at, say, 2 p.m. every day. And it might not happen at 2 p.m. It might happen a little bit after that. Do Do you find that it's that the platform itself is fairly reliable in terms of like the schedule, if you have a scheduled event that you want to have happen, and or like things like not failing in midstream that are more system things instead of like, you know, the way that I built my flow? Does that make sense?
Yeah, from a stability standpoint, I haven't had any issues. Another thing related to plans are how often is flow going to check to see whether it needs to perform some kind of action, right? So with the plan I talked about with the 2,000 executions per month, it could be up to every 5 minutes, right? So if you say, I want something to happen at 2 o'clock, it might not happen until 2:04, right? Okay. Same thing with if I add an item to a SharePoint list, the flow might not actually execute for up to 5 minutes. Now, generally, it doesn't take that long, but they won't guarantee that it won't take that long, right?
Gotcha.
But from that standpoint, no. Where I find instability is once you get into any kind of complexity in your flow, the flow editor becomes a little bit unstable. So for example, you know, you try to edit an expression and it just won't take. So you have to delete the expression, recreate it. There's other things around, you know, trying to navigate through complex flows in the editor. Having one of those like as gigantic a monitor as possible helps a lot because you're scrolling a lot, both vertically and horizontally when you're working with flows. And trying to maintain or refactor flows, it can be quite difficult. Not because of the editors being unstable, just because of how flow works, right? Actions are dependent on other actions and trying to move them around, the dependencies will just tell you you can't do it. So that's a little bit problematic as well. But from an actual execution stability, I haven't had any issues, no.
Yeah, and those things you just described to the challenge of moving things around. I mean, with any kind of a business process, whether it be a workflow in Microsoft Flow and like even in Zapier, all those tools of moving those things around, none of them really support that whole thing of moving it around because of like what you said, things are all, you're chaining a process together and you can't just kind of bring it in, drop it into another section, just be like, oh, look, it all just works. Like, nah, it doesn't just work like that. There's a lot of things that are wired together and those hard connections. And you do have to delete and recreate stuff at times.
Yeah. And another thing, just from that standpoint, that, you know, as a developer drives me crazy is, you know, it's been ingrained to us as developers, don't repeat yourself, right? Don't write the same thing over and over again. And there are many, many scenarios within Flow where you have to do exactly the same thing. Well, almost exactly the same thing in several places, right? And that's just a little bit frustrating. It'd be really nice if I could just say, take this entire tree of actions and copy and move it over here or whatever, or copy and paste it over here, as opposed to just having to recreate the actions over and over and over again.
Yeah, that is what it is. I mean, that's one of the things, just, I guess you could create a, that's where the functions come in, or one flow calling into another flow that could be, make it a little more reusable if you can get that. When you do that, is it pretty instantaneous? So like if I say, go make this HTTP request, is it do like,
you'll get a slight delay, but not a significant delay.
Okay. So, but my flow can kind of, do you end up chaining multiple flows together, or is it, I want this flow to go do some stuff and then go to sleep until it gets a response? Do you have that capability, or is it, you're going to end up chaining multiple ones together?
For certain actions, for example, the approval action, right? So if you say start an approval, it will notify the user or users that there's an approval waiting for them. And the flow won't continue until those users respond in some way, right? Or an individual user. It really depends. Let's say, for example, I have 3 users and I say this specific approval needs all 3 of them to respond. So it will either respond if one of them rejects or all 3 of them approve. But it won't move on in the flow until that happens, right? So some of the actions have a delay. And then for HTTP requests, there's actually this concept of long-running HTTP requests. So if you modular, I can never say that word. If you make it moduled through these HTTP requests, right, you can have requests, like normally I think it's 2 minutes, right, an HTTP request times out. So you can have long-running ones. So I can have an approval within an HTTP request flow. So what it does is when the first flow calls into the second flow through the HTTP request, the second flow, it immediately returns, I think it's a 422 accepted. And then the first flow will then pull the second one until it gets an actual response back. So I have an example where I have an approval going on in a flow that I call through an HTTP request. So that could take up to 30 days. And that works just fine, as long as you configure the flow properly.
That's cool. We've talked a lot about this. Do you have anything else that you would like to, that you want to make sure that our listeners would want to pay attention to, or they should check out before we move on to our last segment of our show?
I guess the only thing is I've noticed a lot of Flow, Power Apps and Flow are Flow-specific user groups starting up recently. There's one in DC with Scott Shear is starting it up. And, oh, jeez, this is my horrible memory. Melissa.
I think I know who you're talking about.
Tell me that I can't remember her last name. Anyway, so yeah, so they're starting one up and I've seen, you know, other things. So there's a lot more Flow community starting up. So that's something that I would definitely take a look at. And just on the internet, there's a lot more Flow content coming out. And one thing back to what you talked about a little bit earlier is Flow is evolving just so rapidly. Like just in the time that I've been using it, when I first started out, there was no way to move a file between folders. Then they added the SharePoint HTTP request, which allows you to make the REST API calls that you could use that. And now there's an action. So if it wasn't there 3 weeks ago, keep looking at it to see if those actions have been added for whatever it is you want to do with any of the connectors. So
very cool.
Melissa Hubbard.
Sorry. Cool. No, it's cool.
Bother me until it came to my head.
We'll make sure too that we have, if you have links to some of these different user groups and then some of the people you referenced, if you can provide those to us, we'll definitely make sure to put those in the show notes for listeners to follow up on later.
AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework.
CJ's Hyperfish automates the collection of user profile information from users and organizational directories such as Office 365, SharePoint, Active Directory, and HR systems. The secure service supports on-premises, hybrid, and online environments. Bring your directory to life at hyperfish.com.
All right, Rob, you are a listener of the show, I presume. And
I am.
There are a... We did this little thing at the end of the show called picks. And I gave you a heads up on this, so make sure that you could... I wasn't going to call you out on it unless you had a few picks, but you do have a few picks, and I wanted to give you a chance to share them with our listeners.
Yeah, so I have a pick, and I've been sitting on it for about a month, and I've been just like, every show, it's like, please don't use this pick. Please don't use this pick. Please don't use this pick. And I thought for sure that CJ would use it, because it's related to Peter Jackson, who's a Kiwi, and he's the director of Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and stuff like that. And he recently put out a film called They Shall Not Grow Old, and he took a bunch of World War I archival footage and interviews done with World War I vets in the 50s and 60s, I believe, and did this film. And what he did was he took the, you know, sort of grainy black and white footage from World War I and he restored it and colorized it and put out this film. And the difference between the original footage and the restored footage with sort of audio over imposed. So, you know, for example, if you see a group of people and they're laughing, they'll put that audio on top of it. It wasn't part of the original footage. And I saw some of the interviews around, you know, how they built or how they did the film. And in some cases, they even had lip readers see what the people were saying in the clip and impose that audio over top of it. But for most of it, the audio is coming from actual World War I vets. It's imposed over top of the footage from the trenches, some battle footage. It's more focused on the people rather than the actual fighting. So it's really, really quite interesting. And it's amazing how the technologies evolve for them to be able to take that amount of footage and restore it and colorize it. And I believe he probably used Weta Digital, which was the same company same part of his company that did all the effects for Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit.
This is really cool. I had not seen this until you just brought this up, and it was this is neat. I want to go back and watch this. It's neat that the playbill or like the poster that they end up using for this, it's kind of split right down the middle, and it shows like the old footage on one side, and it shows the footage they restored on the other side. It's amazing the work that they can. As somebody who's done video courses, and I know we don't do very advanced video work, but
right.
We get how complicated video is and how hard it can actually be to work with. This is impressive.
Yeah, well, I know for sure that with The Lord of the Rings for sure, and I believe The Hobbit as well, they did color grading on almost all of it. So that technology that they developed or the ability to do that on large and large amounts of film, I'm sure played a lot into the ability to colorize this. But to restore it the way they did, when you look at the documentaries on this, they show the original footage and then the restored black and white footage and then the colorized footage. And just the difference between the original footage and the restored black and white footage is remarkable. Right? And I'm assuming that, you know, the vast majority of that work was done by computers, right?
I'm curious to see this. I'm going to check this out. It's a cool find, man.
Yeah. Again, I was just, I'm really glad that no one used it. although I had a NASA pick that I could use as a backup, but I think this one is a lot better. So
space is always welcome here. We do
have I know that.
Actually, that's going to be my pick. And it's kind of related to what you just talked about. So there are, we'll have both of Rob's picks on here. One is a link to the actual film and one is to, there's a YouTube link as well. I think that's to the trailer or no?
Yeah. So the link to the website for the film has the trailer on it. And the second one is an interview. It was a news interview that goes over more of the footage and talks to Peter Jackson about the building of the, you know, how the project started and how the technology behind how he did it.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Yeah, we'll have both of those on there. Well, both of those in the show notes. So my pick, I've been sitting on this one for a couple months here. This one is from the Space Academy and I'll go ahead and post this in our chat here so you can actually see what I'm talking about, Rob, if you like. So it's from the Space Academy and the title is NASA releases 4K video of the moon, ending the moon landing conspiracy. And so what this is it's a, they released 4K video footage of the Earth and moon footage that's going to make your jaw drop. You get some crazy amount of detail that you can take a look at. So one of the videos that it shows is from the NASA Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that was collected over the span of about 9 years. And what you can see in some of the pictures are some of the landing sites from the Apollo program. And you can see the remains of the spider, the lunar module that went down to Earth or down to the moon. And then the top part of it kind of flew back up and that's where they reconnected with the command module and flew home. Well, you can still see the bottom part that they used to land that was still there. And you can even see the tracks leading away from it from when they had the rover, when they took a rover up with them. And how you can see the tracks kind of leading away
I see that in the picture now, yeah.
It's really neat how they did this stuff. So you can see this really crazy level of detail. I got to admit, it's one of the only times I've really wanted a 4K monitor. I don't have a 4K monitor. Now it's like, hey, look, here's some space stuff looking at the moon. I'm like, I want to go buy a monitor just to watch these videos and the true definition. Or I might just go to an Apple or Microsoft store where they've got monitors sitting there. Go grab a link and say, hey, can you share
your laptop? Yeah, I'm going to this monitor for 5 minutes so I can watch
it. Just going to check it. I just want to see how good this really is. Just running a test. So that's my pick for the week. But at any rate, hey, Rob, thanks for coming on the show today. I thought this has been really, it's been beneficial to me. I hope our listeners got a lot out of this. And I mean, being able to use Flow for as a SharePoint developer or even if you're not a SharePoint developer, being able to take advantage of Flow as a power user inside your SharePoint project. So I really do appreciate taking the time and sharing your experiences with us.
Yeah, it's been great. It's always fun to have these conversations. I mean, we have a lot of them, you know, in the speaker room or at the bar. And it's really cool when they actually get recorded so other people can participate or can, you know, get benefit from them. So yeah, it was great. Thanks.
Well, it's nice too. It's like we end up doing that at these different places, these different events and stuff. And like you said, sometimes it goes on at the bar and sometimes that stuff shouldn't be recorded because then after it's we really end up, you know, going off on these like tangents and discussions go a lot longer. But it's nice too because you got a nice solid hour carved out that we can sit down and we can talk about this stuff and put a time box on it. We can get some pics out of it.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks a lot, Robin. It's good seeing you again.
Yeah, thank you.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show, and we'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or an MP3 and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is brought to you by Keith Ritchie. For more information on Keith's music, head to music.kritchie.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter, at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.